Yes. George.
San Diego.
Sorry.
Hi, I'm George. I'm an alcoholic. And it's a light crowd tonight, and I told my wife it's probably because I'm speaking. And but I didn't even know I was speaking until about 10 minutes ago. So thanks. I haven't done this in a while. I've done this quite a few times, but and my story hasn't changed. It's gotten added to a little bit. But I'd like to start out with a prayer to kind of center me. So it's the God, or I offer myself to you to build with me and do with me as thou wilt. Relieve me of the bondage of self, that I may better do thy will. Power and way of life. Amen. Thank you, guys. I got here in 1989. I started drinking at about 14 years old. And I remember I was raised in a family, a Catholic family. I went to Catholic school for eight and a quarter years. And somewhere around the same time I went through puberty, I made a deal with God that if he'd quit, he'd quit demanding stuff from me, which is what I thought he was doing. I'd quit asking him for things. And God and I both kept that deal for a lot of years. There was a lot of fear involved when I came into AA and I heard the suggestions you guys had for me. And one of them was find a power greater than yourself that can restore you to sanity. And I didn't have any problem at all with the insanity part. Because the things I did, the trouble I got into and the things I did when I was drinking, and I don't know how many times I swore off forever. And then about a day or maybe 2 days later, I'd be at it again and back in trouble again. I just was afraid that God was like me. And he was held a grudge like I did, and that he was just waiting all these years for me to ask him back into my life so he could fling the proverbial lightning bolt at me or whatever it is. And but I got beat up bad enough in my alcoholism, and I pray that you all get beat up bad enough to get this thing that I was willing to take that chance and ask God back into my life. And that didn't happen right away. In July '89, I swore off forever again, and I kept smoking those wacky tobacco cigarettes and a few other things. But I actually quit drinking for a while. And I remember 4th of July, we went up to my family's house up in I don't remember if it was Huntington Beach or where we went, and they were all hiding their booze from me. They all they all realized that their older brother, me, needed to quit drinking. And so they were drinking beer and whatever. None of my family are alcoholics except myself. And I used to say my dad was, but that's not for me to say. He died when I was like 26 years old. So and then I came back and I was still hanging around with my same friends and I was still hanging around the same places. And it's inevitable, and I didn't take any of the suggestions that you guys had, and it's inevitable that I would drink again, and I did. And, I kind of tried to hide it for a little while, but I don't think I was very successful at all doing that. And it was finally, at one point in that time, I remember overhearing my daughter telling her mom, asking her mom, when she said, "When are you going to get rid of the drunk? You promised." And I knew they were talking about me because I was the only drunk in the house. And It hurt, but it wasn't enough for me to get sober. So I continued down the path. I may have maybe stopped for a day or two then, but just everything crumbled around me. I was ready to lose a job. I was ready to lose a wife. I was ready to lose a family. And I decided to, I was beat up bad enough to really want this thing. So I came back. I remember telling myself, I'm going to go back to AA, and I'm going to take all the suggestions you guys have to the very best of my ability, and then I'll see. Well, really what I said was, then when it doesn't work, I'll be able to say at least I tried. And so I came back, and it was funny. I had gone to a little over a year that I was from my first meeting till then, I went to this one meeting maybe six or seven times, and I went back to that meeting. It was closest meeting to my house, and it was on a Sunday night. And I drank that morning, but I didn't drink again until I went into. I didn't drink again ever, actually. But I didn't know that at the time. I thought it'd be just like all other times. And what happened was all these people came up to me and appeared and just. You know, there's a saying around here that says, or saying in life, that when the student is ready, the teacher will appear. And that's what happened to me at that meeting. And this one guy came up to me, and he was, he sounded like maybe he taught Bill Wilson everything he knew about the program. He was a professional salesman, and he was a talker, and he'd been around the program. This was in 1990. And he sounded like, you know, he knew everything about it. He talked the talk, and I asked him to be my sponsor because that was another suggestion they had. And he was honest enough to tell me he couldn't be my sponsor because he hadn't worked all the steps yet. And his name was Harry Hoddle. He died a few years back, and it was we became best friends. We just did everything together. And he took me up to another guy. He said, ask him to be your sponsor, and I did. And he said he could be my sponsor, and he's still my sponsor today. It's 28 and a half years later. So our relationship has changed from somebody that's taken me through the steps and to friends. And Wayne was saying something about my hat. It says 33rd annual Broken Neck Trout Campout. And there was a guy around here named Dick Gilmore, and he's gone now too. And he befriended me, and he took me to a camp out at the river first, and then he asked me to go to this thing up in the Sierras in September. And he said, you got to do all the work though, because when you're new there, and it was at the time it was like 40 or 50 guys, sober alcoholics, and all men, and it was up at Lake Mary, up in the Mammoth Lakes Basin, and we camped around the boat rental place, it was a lesson that I learned I didn't have to be a glum person just to be sober. I was able to have a lot of fun, and I kept going back to that. It's moved. It grew to over 200 sober men, and we outgrew the place we were at. We went to another place down the other side from Mammoth in Red's Meadow Valley, and we outgrew that. Now we're up at June Lake, and there's a lot of things I was doing then, started doing that was fun, but this thought came into my mind a lot of having a drink, and I didn't probably go a whole day without thinking about it. I didn't do it. I didn't take a drink. But I didn't smoke any more wacky tobacco, and you know, I was clean and sober, and I was working on the steps, and I was going to a handful of men's meetings, and at one of them we had a hot seat up front that the guy that's sharing on a little raised platform, this guy got up there, we started calling him Fired Up Chuck, and he was. He got up there and shared about taking his fifth step, and he found a Catholic priest that was in the program. Actually, I think he was a Monsignor which I can't remember the pecking order, but he took it with him, and he said, "And I'm fired up, man." And he was fired up, and I was called on to share next, and I got up and said, "Well, I'm working, still polishing up my fourth step. I want to get all the grammar correct and the periods all in and the I's all dotted." And my sponsor was in the back of the room, and he says, "You're done." He says, "Meet me tomorrow or Sunday." He said, "Meet me Sunday at where his place. He had a business, and we'll do your fifth step." And I thought, well, I read the book, and the book says think long and hard about who you pick to listen to. And it doesn't have to be your sponsor. Make sure it's an understanding. And I thought all this, and, you know, and I had some crazy ideas about who was going to listen to mine. I thought, well, an infant would be good, you know. But out of my mouth came, "Okay, I'll be there." And I showed up, and I did as thorough as a fifth step with him as I could. And you know, it's scary going into it, but it's not so scary once you've done it. And about 2 weeks later, I was at work, and this guy walked in, and I hadn't seen him in a couple years. And a little bit about me, I was kind of a petty thief. I wasn't ever a bank robber or a big-time criminal, but I've spent a few nights in jail, and for petty stuff, for drunkenness, and this guy walked through the shop one time, and he dropped his wallet. He pulled his handkerchief out, and his wallet fell out, and I happened to see him as he was going out the door. I saw the wallet there, and I didn't steal it. I just kind of kicked it under my toolbox till later. And I took the money out, and I don't remember. There was somewhere around $100 in it, and so I call. This guy walked in, and all this. I didn't leave it out of my fifth step intentionally or my fourth, but I realized that I omitted it, and so I called my sponsor and I told him what I did. And the guy was going to be in town. He was moved up to Montana, and he was going to be there for 3 days, I had to make that right. I had to make amends for that. And I really wasn't even quite there to my amends step yet. And I asked my sponsor what to do, and he said, "You got any money?" And I said, "Well, I've got some money I'm saving towards a house payment at the end of the month." And he said, "Well," he asked me how much it was, and I said, "I think it," and he said, "Well, offer him that." I had $200, and he said, "Offer him that $200 and tell him what you did. Explain it and ask him if that would make it right for all the trouble he had to go through." And I told him, and his jaw dropped. And he never heard anything like that, but he took the money and turned around and never saw him again. You know, but I was free. I was free of that. And that's the power of making an amends. And the funny thing about that was this reinforced my belief in a higher power. As we played a football pool at work, and it cost $5 to get in, and it depended on how many people were in it was how much the payoff was. And I won it that week, and the payoff was $205. And I remember thinking, "Oh, there really is a God." And I can't remember. I think it was the guy that took his cape. I forget what his name is, but he talked about Alfredo. Yeah, he talked about going through good times and bad times, and that's true. And that guy that became my best friend, he used to go up to this camp out with me, and he couldn't even walk across the street without stopping in the middle because his legs would give out, and he had no circulation in his legs was the problem. And he went to the doctor, and they checked that out, and they were going to do a procedure where they take, just like they do on a bypass of your heart, they take veins out of your legs, they take them from somewhere, and they were going to put them in his main arteries to his legs so he could get circulation again. And then they found out he had his arteries in his heart were plugged at the same time, so they had to do an open heart surgery first, and he recovered from that, and then they did this procedure, and he didn't have to do it, but he wasn't going to be able to walk if he didn't, and he didn't want to be that, we talked about it, he didn't want to not be able to walk. So he said, I'm willing to take the chance. And so they did this procedure, and he was in the hospital, and we'd go up every handful of us would go up there every day, and they had a little black box with a thing you could put in your ear, and you could listen to his veins, his arteries, to see for they were listening for circulation, and there wasn't any, and it wasn't happening. But we'd listen and we'd pray and and he was getting weaker and weaker and weaker, and I remember that. The day before he died, I don't remember who all was up there, but we circled up with him in the middle of the circle, and we prayed just like we do after a meeting here. And that night he died, and I lost my best friend. My program was strong enough. I was strong enough. My connection with God was strong enough to get through that without even thinking about taking a drink. You know, the first time I realized that this thing was going to work was I was about 60 days sober, and Thanksgiving there's a big convention in Las Vegas, and we were invited to go with a bunch of sober people, and I was a little excited and a little worried about going to Las Vegas because I didn't know that I used to gamble, and I thought, well, I'm probably going to have a gambling problem. I'm going to have to really watch that, and then booze is free there, and you know they pass it out like. To get you drunker, so you spend more money, I think. But we went there, and I was just immersed myself in the convention, the speakers, and I remember we went. Somebody said, "Well, let's go have prime rib. I know where the best prime rib in Vegas is." So we were walking down the street, and I remember thinking, "I haven't even thought about taking a drink in a long time, meaning a few days. That was a long time not to even think about it at 60 days sober." But that's when I knew. This program was going to work for me because if I didn't even think about it, then it wasn't going to get worse. It was going to get better, and it did. You know, the only time I think about a drink now is in an AA meeting. And I don't think about taking it. I think about how lucky I am not to have to have a drink in all this time. Another thing happened to me my wife, actually, before I got sober, she was a active member of Al-Anon, and I remember at first I read up a little on it, and I thought, you know, you're supposed to be happy, joyous, and free when you get through with those meetings, and she wasn't, and I was still a drunk, so I don't blame her, but at the time I thought... Anyway, there came a time when somebody asked us, I think it was about, wasn't much more than a year so that I was sober. She had a couple years in Al-Anon, and we were asked to speak as a couple somewhere. We kind of rushed our amends to each other on the way up there, so when we spoke, we were able to say we made amends. But it worked. Whatever happened, it worked. She stuck with me, and that little girl that wanted to get rid of the drunk was about 14, and she started acting up, ditching school, and drinking and using drugs, and we didn't know what to do, and I didn't know what to do. I think my wife knew what to do, So at that time, you could take an adolescent kid and lock him up. I don't think you can do that in California anymore, but we put her in a place called API, Adolescent Center. API is still there, but now this was all on the south side of 8. And I remember when she went in there, we went to a shrink, and the shrink said, you need to, he got her, greased the table to get her in there because he said, she's suicidal. You need to get her in there. And so we took her down there, and I think I almost had to tie her up to get her there. And she put her in there, and she went in the back to talk to somebody. And I remember when the door shut, it sounded like a jail door. This wasn't just a wooden click. It was a clank. And she heard that and started cussing us out. And she called us names that I didn't even hear. I was in the Navy, and I didn't even hear words like that. And we were kind of a basket case. all of a sudden I saw this woman that was in like a cul-de-sac across, and we were way in the back, and there was a gymnasium there and some other office buildings, and this woman came walking out, and I said, "Isn't that your friend from Al-Anon?" And it was. And she came in and talked to us and sat there and talked to us for probably, I don't know, seemed like a long time, told us about her experience with her daughters and their drinking and using. And what happened in there, my daughter learned how to talk the talk real well. But she wasn't quite willing to give it up yet. And we had an agreement. We signed agreement that if she screwed up again, we were going to lock her right back up there. Well, she didn't know. They kept her there until the insurance ran out, and they weren't going to do that again. So I didn't know if we could afford it to put her back in there. But one day, she slipped a note under our door, and she said, "You know, I've been drinking, and I've been using, and I'm not anymore. I've got a sponsor now, and I've got some friends. My sponsor told me I needed to tell you this, and you got to have to do what you got to do." And so we didn't lock her up. We kept her there, and she's been sober ever since. So she's 40 years old, and she's got 25 years of sobriety. So she was 15 when she got sober. So that's a miracle. It really is. And she... thank you. The other miracle. Well, I never was able. My mom lived up in L.A. And as I was sober a while. I got promoted, and I got everything just fell into place. People said, "How did you manipulate that?" I didn't. It was just luck. But I got. I was the boss where I worked, and I used to have to go up there once a month to these management club meetings, and they put me up in a hotel and they feed me meals, but instead I would go stay with my mom, and I would we'd go out to dinner together, and I was able to make a living amends to my mother. And when I tried to make direct amends to her, she would always say, "Yeah, but look at you now." And I thought, that I couldn't ask for a better compliment than that. And but my father died when I was 26 in the heart of my disease, and we never got along. A lot of it was because I was a chicken shit little petty thief and a liar, and he knew it. And I remember I used to share at a meeting. I'd say he was an alcoholic, and he drank. I don't know if he was an alcoholic or not. He died too early for it to blossom, I guess, but if he was. But I had trouble trying to make amends to him because he was gone. And it bothered me. It preyed on me. And a friend of mine came back from North Dakota where his dad was buried, and he'd went up there, and he had he has 8 more years of sobriety than I do. But he went up there with about, I don't know, maybe 20 years of sobriety, and went to this dad's gravesite and read him a letter and prayed and just talked to his dad's grave. And I thought, well, I'm going to try that. So I found out where he was buried, and I wrote a letter. And part of my chicken shit petty thieving was stealing his taillights. He had a 59 Cadillac. And they had these bullet taillights, and kids wanted those for their cars, custom cars. And so I stole his taillights, and he knew it, but he couldn't prove it. And I was of the school, if they can't prove it, don't ever admit it. And so I never did. But I went online, and I bought a 59 Cadillac taillight at some expense. And they're shaped like a bullet. They're about, I don't know, 6 inches long, maybe, and about 2.5 inch diameter, and I bought a little plant, and I dug a hole. I looked around so nobody was watching. I dug a little hole in this grave, and I stuck that taillight down in there and put the plant in the taillight. And I hope it's still there. I don't know. I'll have to go back and look. But and then I read the letter to him, and I stayed there probably an hour and talking to him. And when I walked away from there, I was at peace with that. I for some reason that worked. And, you know, that was pretty much the last major amends on my original list. I've added a few since then, but you know, coming away from that, I mean, that preyed on me for years and years, and finally coming away from there at peace with that. And I talk to my dad now all the time, and, you know, I don't know if, you know, we were talking earlier about going to heaven and or not going to heaven, and I don't know if that's where my dad is or not, but I hope I get to talk to him again in one-to-one in the afterlife or whatever. Wayne told a story about the afterlife, and is about these two alcoholics that made a pact, and they said, well, when one of us dies, at some point before the second one dies, we'll come back and tell them what it's like up there. And so the one alcoholic that was died and the other one was still alive, and he went to his sponsor and he said, hey, Jim came back from heaven and talked to me. And his sponsor says, well, what did he say? He says, we got good AA up in heaven and you're leading tomorrow. So I don't know what time it is. Oh, I got time. One of the things that helps keep us sober, or probably the thing that helps keep us sober, is helping other alcoholics to achieve sobriety, and working with or sponsoring or listening to somebody else's fifth step. And there's somewhere in our literature that says we really don't feel we aren't a complete part of this thing until we've taken our own fifth step and we've listened to somebody else take one. And, you know, I've been honored to be able to do that a number of times. And when I first started sponsoring people, I would get these guys. I went to a meeting out in El Cajon, and these people got, I can't remember the name of the place, but it was like a diversion program where these guys that got in trouble and then they went to this diversion. Instead of going to jail, they went to this diversion program. And one of the things they had, they took them to a meeting and they were told, you got to get a sponsor. And most of the time they got a sponsor just so they could go back and say, I got a sponsor, here's his name. And every once in a while, one of them was serious about this program. And I was fortunate enough to have a couple of those guys ask me to sober that were serious about the program. And, you know, most of the people I sponsored back then had mental problems other than alcoholism, and I remember asking God, why me? Why do I get all the nuts? And God says, probably because they identify with you. And I didn't like that, but it's very, very true. And but, you know, I've been 100% successful in my sponsorship because I've stayed sober. I've stayed sober through all of them. And that's what it's all about. You know, I do what I can to hope, you know, and help them get through the steps to stay sober. But the real key is that helps me stay sober. And, you know, I hope right now I've got grandkids. And that was my youngest daughter, the one with 25 years of sobriety. And my son, our son, who's older than her, had two daughters, and we've been tied up for the last 2 weeks with graduations. The one's graduating from high school and going away to college in August. I think she has to go early because she's already on this varsity soccer team. So she's got to go up there and work out with the soccer team. And she's also a 4.2 grade point avid student. So, and the other one graduated into high school from. So she's going away. So we went to her graduation. And now everybody graduates. So I got a grandson. My daughter had three kids, and one of them's 11, and he's graduating into junior high. And the other one's graduating out of kindergarten. And it's like, wait a minute now, come on, time out. When I graduated, it was high school, we made a deal out of it, but not before that. And But you know, they're my grandkids. I'm gonna enjoy them, and I'm gonna do all I can to be their. I used to be grandpa, but the little girl now, she's 2 and a half, and she's changed my name. I'm Papa to her, so I'll take it. I'll take it, and I don't know what their future has, but I just want them to know that their grandpa loves them. And so I've helped coach the 6-year-old. He's 6 years old, graduating into first grade from kindergarten, and this is his third year of baseball. So if you ask him what he's going to be when he grows up, he looks at you like, "Are you crazy? I'm going to be a baseball player," you know. And he's pretty good, but there's a lot of competition out there. So all of them know, you know. I'm their babysitter a lot of time, and I'm their papa, grandpa. We are, I guess, but my wife just recently has stopped working, and you know, I used to joke about this. I'd say that people talk about being a functioning alcoholic, and I used to say, well, what that means is your wife still works, and. So now she doesn't. I guess I'm not a functioning alcoholic anymore. But we started traveling, just two of us. She's mouthing something to me, but I can't tell what it is. But we started going on cruises. Her aunt gave us an Alaskan cruise, I don't know how many years ago, but that was our first cruise, and we've done a number of them. And we've gone on trips to China. We've gone on a trip to Jerusalem, which is I would like to do that one again. We went on a trip to Africa. I'd like to do that one again, too. But now we got one coming up that's, we're going from on the river, on the Danube, and then some other river that cuts across to the Rhine and all the way up to the north end of Europe. We're going through all those countries, and that's one of the areas we haven't been to before. We're going to do that in September. That's our 44th wedding anniversary, September 25th, and that will be actually be in Prague on our anniversary. So, and I'm just blessed that we're able to do those things. I told you I lucked out, and what happened is a bunch of people at work quit, and they took this chance. They got this. I got offered to go to El Paso to a company, and I said, "How much does it pay?" And they said, "Oh, you just name your price." You know, my head went, poof. You know, name my price. Wow. Well, what that means is if I said, "Okay, how about $1 million a year?" That meant I was interested, right? They're not going to give it to me, but you know, I was. My ego was too big to realize that at the time, but my wife is a little cooler head than me, and she said, "Well, if you go, you're going to go by yourself." And I decided I'm not going. But these other people all went, and thank you. That's how I got to go into management supervision. Then another thing happened where they posted a job that I was really qualified for, but I wasn't the only one in the company, and. I never got an offer, I never got an interview, which was kind of an unwritten or even a written rule that anybody within the company that applied would get an interview. And all of a sudden I read a bulletin, this other guy got the job. Well, he was well qualified. There was no, but I was a little angry that I didn't even get an interview. And I went to my boss and I told him that. And he apologized and, you know, and I found out he bumped me up a level at the company, which gave me I got into the bonus system. I got, when I retired, I got to keep my family members on the medical insurance until they got eligible for Medicare. It was really a lot better than getting that job, because a year later they eliminated that job, the one I was in. You know, I have had things like that happen throughout this, and I think it's God looking out for me, I have something called faith now, and you know, I don't know, I can't describe God to you. In fact, another little story about a kindergarten class, and they were free time, and they had 10 minutes to draw a picture. And the teacher went around, she's looking, and she said, "Mary, what are you drawing?" "So I'm drawing a picture of God." And Mary, and the teacher says, "Well, nobody knows what God looks like." And Mary said, "Well, they will when I'm done with this picture." And you know, I guess I got a little bit of time left, but I think I'm out of gas. So I'm going to thank you guys for putting up with me. And you all know there's a picnic this Saturday put on by the central office, and the area are joining together for first time in a few years, and it's at, what's the name of the park? You don't remember. It's a park by Grossmont High School. Harry Griffith Park, yeah. And bring kids, because my grandkids are going to be there. And we're going to, I'll be helping cook hot dogs and hamburgers. And so be there. It's I think it starts at 10:30. 10 even. Yeah. Till 1:30 or 2. Thank you, guys.